Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Joshua chapter 11, verses 1 through 23, the entire chapter. This will be entitled Conquest in Northern Canaan. Our context is this. In the last chapter, we see the conquest of a lot of Canaanite kings in southern Canaan. So we now begin with Joshua 11:1. Then it came about when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Akshphath. And I'm going to stop right there because I know you don't know where any of these places are. So what I'm going to do is do a brief geographical survey. I'm looking at two different maps. You know where the Sea of Galilee is? Right to the west of roughly the middle of the Sea of Galilee, is the town of Madon. And then, if you keep going west, you get to the tip of Israel that sticks out into the Mediterranean, upon which is Mount Carmel, famous landmark. And you go south of Mount Carmel, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 miles, is Dor, famous place. I'm going to look at another map now. Hazor is most of the way between the Sea of Galilee going north till you get to Lake Hula, a smaller lake. It's in the Araba Valley there as you go up between the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula. Now, if you go to the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee and go directly west as you head toward the Mediterranean Sea, and you go maybe three quarters of the way there, is Shimron, a place otherwise not too well known. And if you look at Acre, now the way you orient yourself with the cities on the Mediterranean coast is you start with Carmel and then you go up the coast, you get to Acre. Now you're at the very northern end, even with the northern end of the Sea of Galilee. Acre was never actually conquered by Israel, but it was distributed. It was given to them as a right by Joshua. And you keep going up the coast, you get to the famous city of Tyre, and then you go further up the coast toward Lebanon, and you get to Sidon. So Acre, Tyre, and Sidon as you go from south to north. Now, all of this northern confederacy of pagan tribes allied against Joshua and the Israelites was organized by Jabin, king of Hazor. Now, Hazor, again, is the city. It's right on the southern tip of Lake Hula, which is that little lake right north of the Sea of Galilee. I say the southern tip, and also to the west a little bit, is Hazor. Now, what can we say about Hazor? First of all, its king, Jabin, was a common name for all the kings of Hazor. It meant the intelligent. Jabin, the intelligent. It's probably an hereditary title because it shows up a lot. He had to be intelligent, I imagine, to arrange this northern confederacy. Hazor itself, the name means enclosed or fortified. I'm going to give you some information about Hazor because it shows up later in biblical history. It's nice to know this place. This is from Easton's Dictionary. It was a stronghold of the Canaanites in the mountains north of Lake Merom. Now, Lake Merom was later named Lake Hula. So Hazor is near Lake Hula, Lake Merom. Jabin the king with his allied troops here encountered Joshua in a great battle, which we're going to read about in a minute. Joshua gained a signal victory, which virtually completed his conquest of Canaan. This is in verses 10 through 13 of our present chapter. We'll get there in a minute. This city was, however, afterwards rebuilt by the Canaanites and was ruled by a king with the same hereditary name of Jabin. His army, under a noted leader of the name of Sisera, you might remember him, swept down upon the south, aiming at the complete subjugation of the country. This powerful army was met by the Israelites under Barak. You might remember Barak, as in Barack Obama. This Barak, who went forth by the advice of the prophetess Deborah, famous story in Judges. The result was one of the most remarkable victories for Israel recorded in the Old Testament. We'll see that in Joshua 19. We'll get there also in Judges and 1 Samuel. The city of Hazor was taken and occupied by the Israelites. It was fortified by Solomon to defend the entrance into the kingdom from Syria and Assyria. And if you look at the Araba Valley up there, which Lake Hula is in the middle of, you keep going north, you get to the Lebanon Mount Hermon, which is on the southern tip of the Anti-Lebanon Range. And, of course, if an enemy wanted to come down in the middle of the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon Range, they'd come right down through there and right down south into Israel. All of Israel's enemies came from the north. Or they could come down on the eastern side of the Anti-Lebanon Range from Syria. So Hazor was a place of strategic importance. Solomon fortified it to keep the Syrians and the Assyrians out. When Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrian king, invaded the land, this was one of the first cities he captured. carrying his inhabitants captive in Assyria. We'll see that in 2 Kings 15. So you see, Hazor is an important military city. Now, these other cities that I told you about, Madon means strife, Shimron means watchpost, and Akshaph, I like this one, means fascination. I like to live in the city of fascination. These cities, I know you're not going to remember where they are, but these cities, if you look at a map, they're spread out from the northeast to the southwest, and then some sprinkled in between. In other words, this man was scared, I project, Jabin, and he was getting help, and he was getting help in strategic places. One little minor point here at the end of verse 1, or actually in the middle of verse 1, the text says, "Then it came about when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it." Well, what is the it? Well, that would be all the marvelous military victories of Joshua and the Israelites before the taking of Jericho and Ai, the defeat of the 5 Amorite kings in the south, and the conquest of all the rest of the southern part of Canaan. And so he knows he's got a big, big problem. Jabin does. We go to verse 2 of Joshua 11. "And to the kings who were of the north in the hill country," he's still getting his allies together, "of the north in the hill country," I'm assuming that's the hill country that's right around the Sea of Galilee there, and it says, "And in the Arabah south of Chinneroth," Chinneroth is the Sea of Galilee. The Arabah is in the valley. That valley, by the way, runs all the way from north of Lake Hula to the Sea of Galilee, all the way down to the Dead Sea, all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, and on out into the Red Sea, and on out into the Indian Ocean. So that's Arba is a huge, long rift, a huge, long valley. But we're up in the north now, so up in that valley there, Hazor was in that valley, actually. But also south of Chinneroth, and Chinneroth might be the Lake of Galilee, or it might be the city of Chinneroth, which is on the northwestern edge of the Sea of Galilee. And in the lowland, now, that could be, the NIV has that as the western foothills. These terms are so fuzzy and ambiguous. I just always say lowland and think Shephelah going toward the Mediterranean Sea, and the plains down there are low as you get out of the hill country. And on the heights of Dor, I've already mentioned Dor, right south of Carmel on the coast. Now the kings who were north in the hill country, we don't know exactly where that is. John Gill says it's north of the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges, which is way up there, up toward Syria. Be Mount Hermon, which is a little bit further north on the toe of the Anti-Lebanon Range, or it could be some mountain not far from Lake Chinneroth, which is further south at the Sea of Galilee. As Adam Clark says that, who cares? It's just kings up there, because all the kings around this Lebanese northern territory, north of Israel, they were all Canaanites, and Jabin got them into the coalition. Now, I told you what the Arabah was, the normal meaning of Arabah, but some people say it's not Arabah. Some people say it's plains. The KJV actually has plains, and that could mean it's referring to the famous plain of Jezreel, which runs right through the middle of the northern country there from east to west. It's 2 miles wide, 10 miles long. Or it could be the valleys of Mount Hermon itself, that range of mountains which is called Mount Hermon. Or it could be the valleys of some mountain near Lake Chinneroth. Those are all speculations. Let's just take it as Arabah, which is the rift between the valley, if you will, between Lake Hula and the Sea of Galilee. I mentioned Dor, right on the coast, on the Mediterranean coast, right south of Mount Carmel. Dor means dwelling. This is sort of interesting, so I'm going to read you some information from Easton's about Dor. It means dwelling, the Dora of the Romans, an ancient royal city of the Canaanites. It was the most southern settlement of the Phoenicians on the coast of Syria. The Phoenicians, of course, are the inhabitants of present-day Lebanon. The original inhabitants seem never to have been expelled, although they were made tributary by David. It was one of Solomon's commissariat districts. I don't know what commissariat means, actually. It sounds like a place to supply you with food. It has been identified with Tantura, so named from the supposed resemblance of its tower to a tantur, a horn. This tower fell in 1895, and nothing remains but debris and foundation walls, the remains of an old crusading fortress. It is about 8 miles north of Caesarea, quote, "a sad and sickly hamlet of wretched huts on a naked sea beach." Now, that was in the 1800s. I don't know what it's like now. We go now to Joshua 11:3. Still, Jabin is getting his coalition together. The Canaanites in the east and the west. Let's just take them one at a time. The Canaanites in the east and the west. Now, that's the particular term for Canaanites, which are the people that lived in Phoenicia. The ones in the east would be near the Jordan River, according to the commentator Benson. The ones in the west, of course, are the ones near southern Lebanon. The Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, they were scattered about in several parts of the country. I've already gone through this so many times as we go through this. The Amorites were actually large. They were everywhere, all over Israel, especially on the eastern side of the Jordan, but also on the western side, about halfway up, going north. The Hittites, of course, were a part of a major empire centered and occupying present-day Turkey, but some branches of them had gotten down into Israel, some of them way down in the south west of the Dead Sea. But these Hittites, of course, will be north. This is where they are. They're coming down into from Turkey into Syria in the north. The Perizzites, some are said to be near Mount Carmel. I've also seen a map with them down further south. These tribes, they're fluid. They move. Hard to pin them down. Jebusites are easy. They're near Jerusalem. Jebusites in the hill country. So, I mean, he had people. Oh, also the Hivites at the foot of Hermon. People say Hivites are a branch of the Hittites. They're in the north. In the land of Mizpah. Now, Mizpah is a term that can throw you because Mizpah is everywhere in the Old Testament. The name means watchtower, lookout, and naturally people will name their towns Mizpah. This Mizpah is on the southwest slopes of Mount Hermon, northeast of the waters of Merom, or Lake Hula. So go northeast of Hula, and you get to Mount Hermon in just a few miles, and that's where this Mizpah is. There, as I said, there are many other places called Mizpah, as Adam Clark says. There were several cities of this name, one in the tribe of Judah, a second in the tribe of Benjamin, a third beyond the Jordan in the east in the tribe of Gad, and a fourth beyond Jordan in the tribe of Manasseh, which is the one we're looking at. The famous Mizpah benediction, by the way, is referring to the one in the Transjordan on the east when Jacob had come back from Laban's. I think Laban was chasing him, if I remember. And they had sort of a treaty there, a truce at that Mizpah. That's the most famous Mizpah. This one's not so famous. Now, these pagan Canaanites that were coming from the foot of Mount Hermon. Let's talk about Mount Hermon a minute. The eastern prolongation of the anti-Lebanon range, which I said, reaching to the height of about 9,200 feet above the Mediterranean. That's pretty high. Most of the mountains in Israel are really just hills. It marks the northern boundary of Palestine and is seen from a great distance. It is about 40 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. It is called the Hermonites in Psalms 42, verse 6, because it has more than one summit. The Sidonians call it Sirion and the Amorite Shinir. And by the way, that's the only Amorite word that's left that's been discovered in the modern world. Shinir, which means Mount Hermon. It is also called Baal Hermon and Sion. There's every probability that one of its three summits was the scene of the Transfiguration. The Dew of Hermon is referred to in Psalm 89:12. Its modern name is Jebel Sheikh, the chief mountain. Chief because it's big. It is one of the most conspicuous mountains in Palestine or Syria. In whatever part of Palestine the Israelite turned his eye northward, Hermon was there, terminating the view. From the plain along the coast, from the Jordan Valley, the Arabah, from the heights of Moab and Gilead, the Transjordan area, from the plateau of Bashan, east of the Sea of Galilee, the pale blue snow-capped cone forms the one feature in the northern horizon. Our Lord and his disciples climbed this high mountain apart one day and remained on its summit all night, weary after their long and toilsome ascent. During the night he was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun. That's assuming that Mount Hermon is the Mount of Transfiguration. I think people dispute that because people don't really know where the Mount of Transfiguration was, but it's interesting speculation. And we get the idea of what a big deal and a big mountain this Hermon was. So, Jabin's been busy. He's got a lot of allies. And we need to think about this. Not only the allies spread out geographically, strategically, there's a lot of them. So this is a big deal that Joshua has to do here. A challenging military environment. Joshua 11 verses 4 through 5. They came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore. Well-known Hebrew metaphor. Usually it refers to Jews descended from Abraham. But this time it's the pagans with very many horses and chariots. Verse 5. So all of these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Now, all that geography I just went through, they all went to one place at the waters of Merom, which is Lake Hula, which is right north of the Sea of Galilee. So this is a big battle, concentration of a lot of forces. Now, the fact that there were so many of the soldiers that were fighting Israel as many as the sand of the seashore. That would very likely would tend to demoralize the Israelites. And to boot, these pagans were fighting a defensive war on their home territory. And as you know, in warfare, there is no army harder to beat than people defending their homeland. And in addition to that, they had many horses and chariots, which the Israelites did not have. These horses and chariots, of course, came from Egypt. They were famous for that. These chariots were made of iron. We see that in Judges 4:3. The sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he, this is referring to another Jabin at Hazor, not this Jabin, had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. This is the story of Barak and Deborah going up to beat that Jabin. But you see that even later, in the time of the judges, a couple of hundred years later, look at there, they've still got these iron chariots. And they were armed with iron hooks. The charioteers would cut down Israelite soldiers as they drove along. And as such, they were very formidable and terrible, as John Gill points out. They had iron scythes, which is a sickle, a curved blade, fastened to poles so that the charioteers could carry them on their hands, I believe that's what happened. And also these iron scythes were attached to the wheels of the chariot, so they would just slice up whatever Israelite was next to the chariot wheels. These chariots appear for the first time in the Canaanite War. And the fact that Jabin of Hazor and his allies were using these chariots, this probably determined the place chosen for battle by Jabin and his allies, because Lake Hula's level shores would allow the full application of the chariot's force. Now let's talk about Lake Hula, or Merom, where the battle was fought. Merom means height. It's a lake in northern Palestine through which the Jordan flows. It was the scene of the third and last great victory gained by Joshua over the Canaanites. It is not again mentioned in Scripture. Actually, I was on a tour bus driving through where Lake Hula was, and I'm sitting there looking, and I'm thinking about the map, and I finally asked the tour guide, I said, where is Lake Hula? I haven't seen it. He says, oh, that dried up a long time ago. They're sucking water out of it to feed the modern Israeli population. It just drained it. It was flat, maybe even a little marshy. I can't remember. There was no lake there anymore. The Sea of Galilee, by the way, is shrinking also for the same reason. It's an arid land over there, and they need water. Now, Easton says that Lake Hula or Lake Merom was the scene of the third and last great victory. I'm not sure what the first two were. Probably referring to Jericho, maybe Ai, and he includes Ai along with all the southern Canaanites. I don't know what he means by third, but let's just put it this way. This is where Joshua beat the pagans in northern Israel. We go now to verses 6 and 7 of Joshua 11. Then the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. So Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom, Lake Hula, and attacked them. Now why did God say to Joshua, don't be afraid? Well, there's a lot of them. They were strategically placed. Well, they weren't strategically placed anymore. They were all gathered at Lake Merom. So let's just say there was a lot of them. And so Joshua needed assurance. And God, good application point here. When you're in trouble, you're facing a battle. If you listen, God will give you assurance that you will be victorious, because God will never leave you nor ever forsake you, as his word promises in Hebrews chapter 13. Now God says to Joshua, tomorrow I will deliver you. Now it's impossible to get from Gilgal to Merom in one day, so God must have told Joshua this on the way. In verse 6 it says, I will deliver all of them, all of the northern Canaanites slain before Israel. That's not literally all, of course, because some were wounded, some were put to flight. It just means many. That word all is slippery. It can mean all literally, or it can mean all in the sense of very, very many. And it also sometimes means each and every category, not each and every individual. But this is a lot of them will be killed. You shall hamstring their horses. That's to keep the Canaanites from using them against the Israelites. Now, a question arises, and also you're going to burn their chariots, so the Canaanites cannot use the chariots against Israel. Now, the next question is why did not Israel use these horses and chariots for their own military purposes? A couple of options to answer that question, John Gill says, or at least one option to answer that question. John Gill says the kings of Israel were commanded not to rely on horses and chariots. That's in Deuteronomy. I'll get to that scripture later in a minute. But I always thought that scripture was to keep the Israelites from turning to Egypt, because they would have to go back and get horses and chariots. Here, they're not turning to Egypt. It would be spoils of war. Getting horses here will not make them rely on Egypt. So I'm not sure that's why. I'm curious as to why. As we go down in a later verse, I'll look at another option too. Well, I just, in advance, talk about it here. So one of my commentators speculated that God did not want the Israelites to become warlike with chariots because they could be very aggressive. And I'm thinking, really? They're being pretty warlike without chariots, and they're being pretty aggressive without chariots. How is chariots, adding chariots and horses, going to make them any less aggressive? I don't know. That didn't make a lot of sense to me. Another option was the Israelites, once they had chariots, would be able to advance beyond the borders that God had allotted for them, and they might try to start conquering surrounding areas such as Syria to the north, such as Moab, Ammon to the east, and this will keep them in their allotted territories. Another theory is that chariots would allow them to travel, not necessarily to fight, but just to travel outside the borders so they could do trade, international trade, and that would tempt the Israelites to be a commercial nation, a trading nation, which would get them all over the world like the Phoenicians did, and God doesn't want them all over the world. He wants them to be agricultural in Israel because he wants to establish Israel for a place for the Messiah. All of that's interesting speculation. Verse 7, so Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly. Now all the people of war, that just means all the people of war that are with Joshua, not necessarily the whole army, as John Gwill says. Now I might ask Mr. Gill, hey, isn't Joshua going to need his whole army to fight this huge enemy army? Well, that might be true, but he's still going to need protection for the women and children back at Gilgal. So however big his army was, I don't think it was all of them. He's got to protect his rear. So Joshua and his fighting men come upon the pagan alliance of Jabin of Hazor. Suddenly, it says, by the waters of Merom, Lakula. Suddenly, Joshua used surprise to win the victory. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says the Israelites probably came at night to effect that surprise. We go now to Joshua 11, verse 8. The Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as Great Sidon and Mizrephoth Maim and the valley of Mizpah to the east, and they struck them until no survivor was left to them. All right, after they whopped the heck out of Jabin there at Lake Hula, Lake Merom, they then proceed northeast to the coast of the Mediterranean. They go all the way up to Great Sidon, which is Sidon. It's called great because of its greatness, wealth, antiquity, and all of its buildings. It's a very famous place. Let's see what Easton's has to say about Sidon. Sidon means a fishery. A town on the Mediterranean coast about 25 miles north of Tyre. It received its name from the firstborn of Canaan, the grandson of Noah. It was the first home of the Phoenicians on the coast of Palestine, and from its extensive commercial relations became a great city. It was the mother city of Tyre. It lay within the lot of the tribe of Asher, but it was never subdued. The Sidonians long oppressed Israel. From the time of David, its glory began to wane, and Tyre, its virgin daughter, rose to its place of preeminence. Solomon entered into a matrimonial alliance with the Sidonians, and thus their form of idolatrous worship found a place in the land of Israel. This city was famous for its manufactures and arts, as well as for its commerce. It is frequently referred to by the prophets. Our Lord visited the coast of Tyre and Sidon, and from this region many came forth to hear him preaching. From Sidon, at which the ship put in after leaving Caesarea, Paul finally sailed for Rome. This city is now a town of 10,000 inhabitants. This is in the 1800s, with remains of walls built in the 12th century AD. And that's enough of that. So, this is the famous Sidon. They went all the way up there. Now, Mizrephoth Maim, according to Easton's again, it means literally burning of waters, supposed to be salt pans or lime kilns or glass factories, a place to which Joshua pursued a party of Canaanites. So somehow these salt pans, lime kilns, looked like water was burning. I'm not exactly sure how. Mizrephoth Maim was located about halfway down the coast from Tyre to Acre. So you go south from Sidon on the coast of the Mediterranean to Tyre, then go halfway to Acre down the coast, and there's Mizrephoth Maim. Now, the Valley of Mizpah, which is mentioned here, that's the Lebanon Valley, according to John Gill, between the Lebanon Range and the Anti-Lebanon Range, which is Coelia, Syria, in the ancient world, that valley between those two prominent mountain ranges. And so basically, Joshua heads up to the north of Israel and then goes all the way up into Phoenicia, wiping out the Canaanites. And they struck them until no survivor was left them, the text says. And again, that's debatable. Does it mean no men, women, and children? Did they take the women as slaves? I'm not really sure yet. I've seen opinions on both sides. But at any rate, they got wiped out. We go now to Joshua 11, verses 9 through 11. Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Then Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor and struck its king with the sword. For Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. Now, the pagan Canaanites gathered at Hazor and fought the big battle, and Joshua beat them, and then he started chasing them all the way up to Sidon. But he hadn't captured the city yet, so he came back. And he wiped out the city of Hazor, which is Jabin's capital city. Verse 11, Joshua 11. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There's that phrase again, utterly destroy. Utterly destroying them, there was no one left to breathe. Then he burned Hazor with fire. How did he hamstring their horses? He cut the sinews and arteries of their hind legs so the horses would bleed to death. So not only could not the horse not walk, they couldn't live. And he burned their chariots with fire. Now, I mentioned this earlier. Once again, I asked the question, why did God not want Joshua to use horses and chariots in his army? Here's what Adam Clark says. So he says, quote, that a warlike and enterprising spirit might not be cultivated among them, and that when obliged to defend themselves and their country, they might be led to depend upon God for protection and victory. On the same ground, God had forbidden the kings of Israel to multiply horses, Deuteronomy 17:16. And this is the verse I said I was going to quote to you. Here it is, Deuteronomy 17:16. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. This prohibition in the law was referring to a future king that Israel might have. Don't go to Egypt looking for horses. Psalm 20, verse 7, some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. Well, all of that does not prove to me why or show to me how it is so wrong for the Israelites to have horses and chariots now. It seems like they would have been of great advantage militarily. But maybe too much of advantage. God wanted them to rely on him instead of on their military hardware. Maybe also, as I mentioned earlier, that chariots would allow the Israelites to travel and do international trade, which would then make them be a trading people, not an agricultural people. And God wanted to focus on their agriculture, which is a settled existence, because he wanted firm boundaries of Israel so that there would be a place for the Messiah to be born into, which is in fact what happened. Verse 11 says they struck every person who was in it. That sounds like men, women, and children, John Gill says. Again, I'll leave that open. There was no one left to breathe. That again sounds like men, women, and children. But it doesn't mean the cattle, because it means every human that breathed. Now, Hazor was burned with fire in verse 11. But remember, Hazor was rebuilt by the time of Deborah, Judges 4:2, and the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin. This is a different Jabin, a couple of hundred years later, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of the army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. So there we have the famous story of Deborah sending Barak to beat the new Jabin, king of Canaan, at Hazor. He had to conquer it again. Now I have a question here. I don't have the answer to it. Why did Joshua particularly burn Jericho, Ai, and Hazor, but he left all the other cities intact? And I don't know the answer to that. I can speculate that since Jericho and Hazor were particularly strategic cities, and Joshua didn't have the troops to garrison the cities, he just burned them down so they could not be used militarily against the Israelites. And I don't know about Ai, why that's particularly strategic. That's just my speculation. We go now to Joshua 11, verses 12 through 13. Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings, and he struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them. There's that phrase again, utterly destroyed, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. However, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds, except Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. I don't think that means that Hazor stood on its mound. It means Hazor was burned. Now, when did God command the Israelites to utterly destroy the Canaanite cities. That's Deuteronomy 7, first two verses. When the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Now, again, utterly destroy could mean you wipe them out as an ongoing geopolitical entity, so they cannot make treaties with anybody, so they don't have an army, don't have a king, don't have a government. It doesn't necessarily mean that every man, woman, and child is burned, although that could be what it means. And even if you prove that God didn't ask the Israelites to destroy all the men, women, and children, as I've said many times before, God nevertheless did do that. He destroyed men, women, and children when he flooded the world. God has the right to judge in any way he wants to. And so if it is true that he wiped out these Canaanite cities and the cup of their iniquity had been filled up and these men, women, and children were just as involved in that horrible idolatry and child sacrifice and incest and whatever else they were doing, and they got wiped out, that's perfectly fine, because a just God can execute justice whenever and however he wants to. I mean, after all, the whole human race deserves to be in hell, and we're not there. Although we deserve to be there, and it would be just for him to put us there, but he hasn't. So we need to quit pointing our fingers at God and say, oh, that's just so unjust. God's a monster. Now, the other cities were not burned, as it says in verse 13. John Gill says about this, quote, reserve them for their own habitations. It means Joshua reserved them for their own habitations. The Israelites did, being well fortified and having no need of new walls being built to them or being in a very agreeable situation. In other words, it was easy to defend. Joshua didn't have to leave garrison troops there. They're sitting up on a mountain. Nobody can climb up the mountain to attack the city. We don't have to build new walls because of those mountains. And so it'll be easy for us to take over these cities without having to expend a lot of manpower. Now, that phrase, don't burn the cities that stood on their mounds, there's an alternate translation for that phrase, and it could be that stood still in their strength. In other words, he didn't burn the cities that stood still in their strength, which means they had made peace with the Israelites. They stood still. They said, we're not going to fight. And so Joshua said, okay, we're not going to burn it down then because you didn't fight. But I didn't see any translation that really translated it that way. Most all the translations say, don't burn the cities that stood on their mounds. And I think that's for a practical reason. It's easy to retain them without a garrison, as I just said. So we go now to Joshua 11, 14 through 15. All the spoil of these cities and the cattle the sons of Israel took as their plunder, but they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one who breathed. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, the Israelites were allowed plunder, not like at Ai where everything was, charim, accursed, dedicated to God. Here they could take plunder. They needed food. They needed cattle. Now they could, and they also could take metalwork too, but there was an exception of things which had been used for idolatry. We read that in Deuteronomy 7, verse 25. The graven images of their gods you are to burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, or you will be snared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. Now notice in verse 14 that the Israelites struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one who breathed. So no one who breathed means no man who was left breathing. Again, that sounds like the women and children and the old people and the infirm, the sick, were not included. The non-combatants. Again, I'll leave that issue up for further study in case you're interested. If I live long enough, I might get into that a little deeper myself. Now all of this plunder and all of this destruction of the city, utter destruction of the cities, was done in verse 15, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, what did God commanded Moses about taking the cities? Well, let's go through them. Well, first of all, I've already read Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 2. It says in verse 2, you shall utterly destroy them and make no covenant with them. Obviously, if you're going to destroy them, you can't make a covenant with them. Also in Exodus 34, 11 through 13, we read this, "But be sure to observe what I am commanding you this day." That's what God is commanding you this day. "Behold, I am going to drive out the Amorite before you, and the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, or will become a snare in your midst. But rather you are to tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and cut down their ashram." All right, there the vengeance of God is directed towards cities that have idols in them and the idols themselves. And you're not supposed to make a covenant with them. Numbers 33:52, "Then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their molten images and demolish all their high places." Again, the idols are going to go bye-bye. Deuteronomy 7:5, "But thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their asherim and burn their graven images with fire." God's not happy with these idols. We go now to Joshua 11:16. "Thus Joshua took all that land, the hill country, and all the Negev, and all that land of Goshen, the lowland, the Arabah, the hill country of Israel, and its lowland." Now, these geographical terms have to be explained, but let me just summarize here and say that now this is a summary of all that Joshua had done, because it includes his conquest in the south of Canaan as well as in the north. Joshua took all that land. That means all of it, the whole land, northern and southern parts. The hill country. Now, Gill says that's the hill country of Judea. I don't know why it can't be the hill country of Judea or the hill country of Samaria. It's that ridge of mountains that goes right up the spine of Canaan. So Joshua took all the hill country, and he took all the Negev. That's in the south. We've already talked about that down there. Machadah, Hebron, all down in there. That was all last chapter. We talk about those conquests. All the land of Goshen. Now, that's not the land of Goshen in Egypt. That's a district in the plain of Judah down there, in the Shephelah between Gaza and Gibeon. Gaza is in the extreme southwest of Israel on the coast. Gibeon is 4 or 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And somewhere in between there, there was a place called Goshen. And then it says Joshua took the lowland. I think that's the Shephelah. I'm not dead sure. Sounds like it to me. The Shephelah is the plain right there on the Mediterranean coast, right where the Mediterranean city, where the Philistine cities were. The Arabah, which is the valley that runs all the way from Lake Hula to the Sea of Galilee, from the Sea of Galilee all the way down to the Dead Sea, and that would be as far as they went. They didn't go any further. The Arab goes further, but the Israelites didn't go any further than that. The hill country of Israel and its lowland. Now, Adam Clark says, "This place has given considerable trouble to commentators." I just think it's a summary of the fact that he took all the hills in the middle of Canaan and the lowland, all the plains on the Mediterranean, and we got it all. Close enough for me. We go now to Joshua 11:17. "From Mount Halak that rises towards Seir, even as far as Baal Gad, in the valley of Lebanon at the foot of Mount Hermon. And he captured all their kings and struck them down and put them to death." This is basically saying from south to north. Mount Halak, what is that? Well, it means smooth or bald, Mount Smooth or Mount Bald. This is from Easton's. "It's a hill at the southern extremity of Canaan. It is referred to as if it were a landmark in that direction, being prominent and conspicuous from a distance." And then some people think they can locate its modern position. I don't worry about that. His point is, it's some mountain. We don't know where it is, but it's somewhere all the way down to the south. "It rises towards Mount Seir." Now, Seir is the mountain range that runs all along the eastern edge of the Arabah Valley from the Dead Sea all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. The people of Edom control that Seir mountain range on the east of the Aqaba there, east of the valley. Some maps have Edom also being on the west, too. But anyway, this is Mount Seir, belongs to Edom, it's famous. Let me read you what Easton says about Seir, the name of a mountainous region occupied by the Edomites, extending along the eastern side of the Arabah from the southeastern extremity of the Dead Sea to near the Aqaba. That's the Gulf of Aqaba. There's that range of mountains. "It was originally occupied by the Horites, who were afterwards driven out by the Edomites." Remember Mount Hor, where Aaron died? It was in the Mount Seir mountain range. "It was allotted to the descendants of Esau." That's where it got its name, Edom. Esau, red, Edom, red, red mountains. Belongs to Israel now, though. "Even as far as Baal Gad in the Valley of Lebanon." Well, the Valley of Lebanon is probably the valley between the Lebanon Range and the Anti-Lebanon Range, which was known in the ancient world as Coelus Syria, which means Hollow Syria. Easton says of Coele, Assyria, this is a name not found in Scripture, given, but it was given by the Greeks to the extensive valley about 100 miles long between the Lebanon and the anti-Lebanon range of mountains. So somewhere that Baal Gad is in there. I'll look at that in just a minute. But at the foot of Mount Hermon, that means that the Israelites had all of Israel all the way up to Mount Hermon, which, remember, was about, I think, 40 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, or maybe 40 miles north of Lake Hula, I can't remember. But it's up there in that area. It's at the southern end of the anti-Lebanon mountain range. Now, what is Baal Gad, or Baal Gad, depending on how you want to pronounce it? We're going to say Baal because that's how we do it down here in the south. Baal Gad. Baal Gad, translated, means Lord of Fortune. So let me read from Easton's. Not only can it mean Lord of Fortune, it might mean Troop of Baal. It was a Canaanite city in the valley of Lebanon at the foot of Hermon, hence called Baal Hermon, also as well as Baal Gad. It was near the source of the Jordan. Now, the source of the Jordan, I've actually been there. It was the most northern point to which Joshua's conquest extended. It probably derived its name from the worship of Baal. Its modern representative is Banias. Now, that's an old name, and I cannot remember the name of the source of the Jordan. I was there. I still remember the caves and all the pagan idols in those caves. But at any rate, that's where Baal Gad is. It's north of Mount Hula, where the Jordan River springs up from some springs, which you can still see today. It's kind of interesting, actually, if you ever get a chance to go there. It's way north, and that's as far as Joshua went. We go down to Joshua 11, verse 18. Joshua waged war a long time with all these kings. Now, you can imagine, that's a lot of kings he had to wipe out. It didn't happen in one day. Let me give you a quote from John Gill. Quote, "For though the account of the conquest of them is put together and lies on a small compass, yet those victories were not obtained at once or in a few days, as were those of the five kings," that's the five kings of the Amorites in the south, "and others related in the preceding chapter." Yes, the conquest of southern Canaan happened very quickly, but this one took a long time. In fact, Adam Clark speculates it was probably 6 or 7 years. He uses a lot of complex calculations, which only a polymath, brilliant intellectual like Adam Clark could do. I'm just going to take his word for it. 6 or 7 years. Clark says there were advantages in taking such a long time to subdue the land. The Canaanites had time to repent. They had sufficient opportunity to discern the hand of Jehovah instead of saying, "Oh, we're going to fight you, Israel." Instead, they could say, "Hey, we quit. We repent." They would have time to do that. Agriculture would continue on during the wars of conquest. Thus, provision was made for the support of the conquerors. In addition to plunder, you got agriculture supporting the Israelites. Now, if the land had been subdued and wasted and burnt all at once, tillage must have stopped. Famine would have ensued, and the Israelites would have died, and wild beasts would have multiplied upon them. So the conquering was done in a gradual fashion. If it had been done very quickly, Israel would have been less affected. They would have been less instructed by miracles that had passed in such quick succession before their eyes. In other words, by taking so long and doing it in a natural way, a natural military way, they wouldn't be relying on miracles. For example, the sun standing still in the valley of Ajalon. It would be a more natural thing, and so then they would become more interested in preserving their inheritance and not expecting God to bail them out all at once. If it had done with miracles, they could have gotten it so easy, and maybe they wouldn't have cared about it as much. Well, that's speculation. Fairly reasonable speculation, though. This is very typical. God does miracles when you're in a jam, but usually when you have to work hard, he says, "I'm not going to do a miracle for you. You got to work hard." Reminds me of this Chinese young woman, 33 years old, couldn't find a husband, and she had her eyes on this guy, an old boyfriend, and things were not going well at the time, and she says, "Why can't God just bring him to me and let him be my boyfriend?" And I said, "Well, if you get hungry, don't you have to go out and buy the steak and put salt and pepper and spices on the steak and then turn the gas on the grill and cook the steak?" God does love to do miracles, but folks, miracles are no excuse for laziness. Once the miracle is done, once you're past the hard spot, the natural methods of accomplishing whatever you need to accomplish kick in, and you've got to do things naturally. And I think that's a good speculation. That's what the Israelites had to do. We go now to Joshua chapter 11, verses 19 through 20. "There was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel except the Hivites living in Gibeon. They took them all in battle." You recall that was because the Gibeonites had made a treaty with Joshua because they fooled him in thinking that they were a long way off and they were not therefore subject to being quote-unquote utterly destroyed because they had different rules because they were far away. The cities that were far away were not to be utterly destroyed. And far away means on the east side of the Jordan. So Gibeon had made peace. But otherwise, all the rest of them, oh no, they did not make peace. They fought and lost and got wiped out. Now the question is, did Joshua offer them peace and they refused the peace? Or did Joshua never give them even a chance to make peace? And I'm not sure about that. I don't think anybody's sure about it. Verse 20, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts to meet Israel in battle in order that he might utterly destroy them. There's that phrase again, utterly destroy. That they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, let's look at this issue. Not a city which made peace. There wasn't one of them except Gibeon. John Gill says of this, quote, according to the Jews, Joshua, upon his first landing in Canaan, sent letters and messages to all the inhabitants of the land, offering them peace on certain terms, particularly that he sent three messages or proposed three things to them, that those who had a mind to flee might flee, that those who were desirous of making peace might make it. They'd probably become slaves then. And they that were for war, let them fight. All the cities were for the last for fighting, and so they perished. Well, so Gil, quoting the rabbis, I don't know if Gil agrees with the rabbis, but the rabbis seem to think that Joshua gave them a chance to surrender, and they didn't take it. I don't know what the answer is. I think it might be a matter of speculation. Now, of course, we have the perennial theological question here. Verse 24, it was of the Lord to harden their hearts. Oh, how could God do that? That makes it impossible for them to repent. Remember, these hardening of the hearts was not a violation of the Canaanites' free will. They fought willingly and freely. The hardening was judicial punishment. The more they used their free will to fight, the more God said, okay, bam, your heart's going to get hard. You brought it on yourself. This, of course, is brought up when it says so many times that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's hearts during those 10 plagues, and he wouldn't listen. Well, it wasn't God's fault. It was Pharaoh's fault. Here's what Clark says about that. He's, of course, an Arminian. Quote, they had sinned against all the light they had received, and God left them justly to the hardness, obstinacy, and pride of their own hearts. For as they chose to retain their idolatry, God was determined that they should be cut off. Well, I agree with Mr. Arminian there, although normally I don't like to agree with Arminians. I don't think there's any problem with what Clark said there. And once again, it says that this utter destruction was done just as the Lord had commanded Moses. I've already read you four verses about that utter destruction. I'm not going to do it again. Joshua 11, verse 21. Then Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. Now we hear about the Anakim. Who were they? Now these guys are interesting because they were giants. This is from Easton's quote. The descendants of Anak, the Anakim, they're the descendants of Anak. They dwelt in the south of Palestine in the neighborhood of Hebron. In the days of Abraham, they inhabited the region otherwise afterwards known as Edom and Moab, east of the Jordan. They were probably a remnant of the original inhabitants of Palestine before the Canaanites, a Cushite tribe from Babel. In other words, these were aborigines, aboriginal giants, before the Canaanites were there. They were of the same race as the Phoenicians and the Egyptian shepherd kings, the Hyksos. You know, I don't know if that's true. I think people are still debating those Hyksos. I can't remember. After reading some Egyptian history, I think that might be an old opinion. But anyway, these old dictionaries. The Anakim were of the same race as the Phoenicians, says Easton's. Their formidable warlike appearance, as described by the spies sent to search the land, filled the Israelites with terror. They seem to have identified them with the Nephilim, the giants. That's the famous Nephilim of Genesis 4 of the antediluvian age. Now, not everybody agrees that the Nephilim were the Anakim. Nobody's ever going to know. I have a little story to tell you here, a little rabbit trail. I have a friend who considers himself an expert on the Nephilim. He said he actually saw one time. And when I pronounced Nephilim to him, he said, no, it's Nephilim. And I thought, I am not going to dispute a man who has seen a Nephilim. I will pronounce it Nephilim, at least in his presence. But I got on YouTube how to pronounce, and it must have been 20 of them, lots of YouTube videos how to pronounce them. One of them said Nephilim, which sounds cool, but most of them said Nephilim, and that's the one I like, so that's what I'm going to say. But these Anakim are giants. The Nephilim were giants. Whether the Nephilim came because the demons slept with the women there in Genesis 6, producing half-demonic, half-human offspring or not, I'm not going to get into that. In fact, I already have gotten into that when I covered Genesis 6. But these Anakim here got wiped out by Joshua. Now, where did they get wiped out from? We see they're everywhere. Hebron, the famous city, is still there. halfway down the western edge of the Dead Sea from Debir, Anab, and the hill country of Judah. I've got a map here. I'm going to look at that. Hebron, if you go due west for about 10, 15 miles, you hit Makeda. That's where the five southern Amorite kings were locked up in a cave with a stone and then executed by Joshua. And if you go down to where Debir is a point southeast of Makeda, about 10 or 15 miles, and Hebron, 10 or 15 miles, and they meet in a point down there at the bottom of an equilateral triangle, that's Debir. And then if you go about, maybe 5 miles to the southwest of Debir, you got Anab. So all the way down here in the so-called Plain of Judah, in the southern area before below Jerusalem, south and southwest of Jerusalem, the hill country was straight south of Jerusalem, and then you go southwest and you get to the Plain of Judah, and then you keep going to the coastland, you get to the Shephelah, and that's where the Anakim were. Now it also says the Anakim were in the hill country of Judah and the hill country of Israel. Hill country of Judah is the mountains around Jerusalem, and the hill country of Israel is the mountains in Samaria, but it's the same mountain range that runs straight up the center of the spine of the Promised Land. Joshua utterly destroyed. There's that phrase again, utterly destroyed. He utterly destroyed the Anakim with their cities, the Anakim cities. Now Joshua preserved other cities, as we saw earlier in Joshua 11:13. He did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds, except Hazar alone, which Joshua burned. But he did destroy them utterly, which I presume meant he made them such that they could not operate as a functioning city anymore. So much for the giants. But now they lasted a while. I'll finish up with what I was reading from Easton's to show that they lasted a while. Joshua finally expelled them, except a remnant that found a refuge in the city of Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. The Philistine giants whom David encountered were descendants of the Anakim. Now you remember Goliath of Gath, famous guy. David bopped him in the forehead with a stone and killed him. That famous story that all kids in Sunday school know. Well, he was an Anakim. He was the descendant of the Anakim, a giant. Now speaking also of driven out Canaanites who came back to the land that they were driven out from, we can look at Hebron and see this phenomenon again. John Gill says this, quote, Hebron was where the children of Anak dwelt when the spies were sent into the land between 40 and 50 years before this. That's the Anakim, the giants. And though the inhabitants of Hebron had been before destroyed by Joshua, these Anakims, who were very likely then made their escape, returned and took possession of it after Joshua's departure. And while he was engaged in making other conquests, as we find that after this, others of the same race again possessed it and were in the possession of it after the death of Joshua, when they were slain by the tribe of Judah. So just because Joshua utterly destroyed a place doesn't mean that that place can't come back, which makes it even tougher for Joshua to wipe out these Canaanites. Clark says that was John Gill that I just quoted from you. Adam Clark says that the Anakim coming to Hebron is just a repeat of what Joshua did. I don't have the verse with me. It's in Judges when Caleb had to drive them out again, which means they had to get there again. Judges 1:10, I found it. Clark just says Judges 1:10 is just a repeat of what we have here in Joshua chapter 11. I don't think so. I think the Anakim came back to Hebron and the Israelites had to drive them out again. We go now to verses 22 and 23 of Joshua 11, and we will be finished with this audio. There were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel, only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod some remained. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. Now, Joshua was not chastised for leaving some Anakim in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. Those are three famous cities, three of the five famous Philistine cities. So I'm assuming that Joshua had done what he was supposed to do and that this was just unfortunate that he couldn't get them all. Well, let's start with Gaza. That's still there. You know, the Gaza Strip's in the news all the time. It means strong. This is according to Easton's, a city on the Mediterranean shore, remarkable for its early importance as the chief center of a great commercial traffic with Egypt. It is one of the oldest cities of the world. As I say, it's still there. It's on the border of Egypt. You go south on the Mediterranean coast till you get to the southwesternmost extremity of Israel, and there it is, and now it's owned, it's the Gaza Strip, now it's owned by the Palestinians. Now, Ashkelon, if you go up the coast from Gaza, you hit Ashkelon, a famous Philistine city. I remember being on a, with a Yemeni Jewish guy who was being a tour guide in Israel, and he drove my wife and me through the Negev desert, and he showed us a pipeline, which is way over there near the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. Had these big fans to keep the heat down. It was really interesting to see this big pipeline, this huge pipeline way up in the air. And he said it was receiving oil from India and the Indian Ocean and from other parts of the world. The oil would go up to the Gulf of Aqaba at Eilat and then across the Negev Desert at Ashkelon and then shipped from Ashkelon to Europe. And that's how Israel was making a lot of money on oil, because of the ability of that oil pipeline to, well, basically it kept oil having to go through the Suez Canal. You got oil into the Mediterranean for Europe. I thought that was interesting. Well, that's Ashkelon. You go up the coast a little bit further is Ashdod. Now you go, and I say on the coast, it's within a couple of miles of the coast. And then you go up the coast a little bit further, now a little bit further inland, I'm, you know, 3, 4, 5 miles, and you hit Ekron. That's the fourth famous Philistine city. And then you drop down about maybe 10 miles or so to the southeast, Gath, the easternmost city of the Philistines. It's at the very easternmost edge of the Shephelah, the plains there, the coastal plains, right there at the foothills of the hills of Judah. And Gath, of course, is where Goliath was from, and where, I don't know where David actually killed him. I don't know if it was in his hometown, but let's put it this way. Goliath was from Gath. Now, Ashdod I didn't mention as I went through that. Let's talk a little bit about Ashdod. The word means stronghold. As I said, it was one of the five Philistine cities, and Easton says this, it's about midway between Gaza and Yaffa, about 3 miles from the Mediterranean. It's not right on the coast, it's close. It was one of the chief seats of the worship of Dagon, the fish god. It belonged to the tribe of Judah, but it never came into their actual possession. It was an important city as it stood on the high road from Egypt to Palestine, and hence was strongly fortified. Uzziah took it in the time of the kings, but 50 years after his death, it was taken by the Assyrians in 758 BC. According to Sargon's record, it was captured in him in BC 711. The only reference to it in the New Testament, where it is called Azotus, is in the account of Philip's return from Gaza. Let me go back to verse 23 here. Once again, Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken. The author of Joshua is very, very clear that all of what was done by the Israelite army was done according to God's command and directions. Now, I read you a bunch of scriptures about how Joshua and the army did what God had commanded Moses. I think I've got another one here, Deuteronomy 11, 23 through 25. Then the Lord will drive out all these nations from before you, and you will dispossess nations greater and mightier than you. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours. Your border will be from the wilderness to Lebanon. That wilderness is the Negev in the south, all the way from Gath, all the way up to Lebanon, all the way up to Mount Hermon, and from the river Euphrates, that's in the northeast, as far as the western sea, that's the Mediterranean. No man will be able to stand before you. The Lord your God will lay the dread of you and the fear of you in all the land on which you set foot as he has spoken to you. Now, I don't think in Joshua that Israel made it to all those boundaries that God said would give the Israelites in Deuteronomy 11. However, in 1 Kings 4:21, we read this, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines and as far as the border of Egypt. Well, the border of Egypt is just south and southwest of Gaza, Wadi El Arish, Euphrates River, all the way up there near Damascus. They offered tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So the Israelites eventually conquered the whole area, the whole land. Now notice that Joshua gave away land to all these tribes, all these Israelites. He gave it. Now, you tend to think when you read that, that he's given it in the name of the Lord and just distributing the land. But personally, he was self-sacrificial, as Clark says. He claimed no peculiar jurisdiction over the land. His own family had no peculiar share of it. And himself, only the ruined city of Timnath-Serah in the tribe of Ephraim, which he was obliged to rebuild. That's all he got. Then in verse 23, the land had rest from war. The question I asked there, did Joshua prematurely stop from wiping out the Canaanites? They were still there in the land, as we see. Or had he done enough? My tendency at this point is that he had done enough. They just didn't finish the job later on. Ladies and gentlemen, we're finished with chapter 11 of Joshua. We're now prepared to move on to Joshua 12, the entire chapter, verses 1 through 24. We will look at the kings defeated by Moses and Joshua, a summary chapter that shows all of the great conquests that the Israelites had done. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.